Welcome to the Crisis Vote, a half hour of updates on a global election crisis. Journalist Dar Jamail provides an update from Baghdad this time, as an election crisis there continues despite a U.S. media campaign to declare the election on track. Even as the interview you are about to hear was taped January 16, 2005, a Sistani-endorsed candidate, Salama al-Khafaji, was ambushed by gunmen in central Baghdad. She escaped this second attempt on her life uninjured, according to New York Post wire services. Back in November, Iraq's Deputy Prime Minister Barham Saleh said elections in Iraq could be derailed by a violent insurgency. As you will hear, the top U.S. military commander in Iraq now agrees with him. The powerful cleric, Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, was hesitant, but chose to participate in the January 30th vote anyway. His endorsed candidates are thought to have a shot at winning. But will Iraqis venture out into dangerous streets to vote? How many Iraqis will vote from abroad? Will the election itself be more important than the lives of Iraqis seeking to vote? Have corporate interests lined up deadlines of their own? And is this why the January 30th date is such a priority? Dar Jamail's reports can be heard regularly on Flashpoints, Free Speech Radio News, Democracy Now!, and the BBC. His articles have been published in Common Dreams, New Standard News, The Sunday Herald, The Nation Online, and his regular dispatch page at darjamailiraq.com, D-A-H-R-J-A-M-A-I-L, Iraq.com. Dar Jamail, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Dori.
There are conflicting reports coming from the White House and the military on security in Iraq now and in the future. Tell us what you can about the situation of security in Iraq. We've seen, again, more violence, more bombings.
Well, the security situation here is horrendous. Every day there are clashes, even in the capital city of Baghdad, and that's not even speaking of very fierce clashes on a daily basis in Ramadi, Fallujah, Samarra, Mosul, Baquba, Beji, Latifiyah in the south, Amara in the south. There is heavy fighting all around Baghdad on a daily basis. We have, of course, many of the provinces, in fact, four of Iraq's 18 governorates will be unable to host elections because of violence and because of the electoral commissions have stepped down in several of these provinces. So it's the idea of having any sort of election in conditions such as this is rather absurd.
Dar, it almost seems that there are two realities for every question. One, you know, how many Iraqis can vote both in Iraq and outside of the country. And then as to security, we have White House press spokesperson Scott McClellan explaining that the president feels Iraq is secure enough to proceed with January 30 elections. Meanwhile, the State Department and other agencies see a much darker picture, and even the top U.S. military official in Iraq, General George W. Casey, has explained that despite the coalition's efforts to secure Iraq, violence will be unavoidable on Election Day. These reports coming from Agence France-Presse and other news sources, AP, Reuters, etc.
Well, again, we see the consistent disparity between how the Bush administration views things, which is not rooted in reality whatsoever, versus what even other people, such as some of the information sources in the State Department or foreign media, really report as the truth, or even the highest-ranking army general here in Iraq, which is, of course, it's an untenable situation regarding elections here. If Scott McClellan and or Mr. Bush think it's so safe to have elections here, they should come over here and witness them themselves and go on the streets to really back that up, because the reality is there are scores of Iraqis dying on nearly every single day. U.S. soldiers are dying here almost every single day. The average is 2 to 3 dead soldiers per day, 10 times that number wounded, at least 75 attacks per day, at least, on the U.S. military here, and things are, of course, worsening by the day where the infrastructure is in shambles, and again, this idea of having these elections for this arbitrary date that has been set at this time when the majority of people here outside of the followers of Grand Ayatollah Sistani, the largest Shia cleric in the country. Aside from that, most everyone else feels that the election should at least be delayed. It's a very complex situation because while there are some groups that have claimed, more than one group, in fact, that has claimed responsibility for that, of course, the rumor mill of Baghdad is going, and some people feel it could be CIA or things of this nature to try to further this idea of a split between the Sunni and the Shia, which would, of course, lend the idea of potential civil war after the elections, which would, of course, justify an ongoing occupation. Because the reality on the ground is, despite the political rift between the Sunni and Shia, on the ground with the Rockies, there is no split. There is not much of a division to speak of. There never has been a civil war between the Shia and the Sunni. And most people feel that it will not happen, only that it is being focused on by the media, particularly that of the West, particularly in America. And Iraqis, just to give you an idea, we have families, many, many families, where there's a Sunni husband and a Shia wife. We have tribes where they're both Shia and Sunni. So really, if you ask most Iraqis, they feel, no, there probably won't be any kind of civil war. We've never heard this talk between differentiating between Shia and Sunni before the invasion. This is a new thing.
What kinds of things can you tell us just in general about the intensity of this violence and who might be looked at as, let's say, an organized group that could bring the violence level down?
Well, really, the cause of the violence, if we look at the history of the occupation, there was hardly any attacks whatsoever in the first few months. Most Iraqis supported the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, and most people were hopeful that they would be given a chance to rebuild their country and have jobs and have an opportunity for a better life. But after 3 months, when absolutely nothing happened, they saw everything destroyed, and then they saw the U.S. military begin to have these home raids and detain people. The stories of torture started almost immediately to circulate around Iraq. People started dying. And, of course, more and more people then began to support and join the resistance against the military. The resistance may have started out with more primarily ex-army and Ba'athist element, but now it's comprised more and more of people who've simply had family members killed or detained or humiliated by the occupation forces. And as far as bringing some sort of change to lessen the violence, really, again, it comes back to broken promises by the occupation forces that if there were jobs created and Iraqis given more of their share of these contracts to rebuild their own country and people had a way to make money and support their families, this, I think, would be the biggest hope to lessening the violence and cause the resistance to fade away if people simply had a way to support themselves and did not have reason to hate and be against the occupation forces. Imagine if your home was raided by occupation forces the night before and not having a job and having to figure out a way to try to get money to feed your family and going outside, braving the streets where there's fighting at times. No one has any idea when this is going to occur. Kidnappings, crime is several times than in the worst city in the U.S., and going out and trying to find work in an environment with 70% unemployment, on average 4 to 6 hours of electricity per day. There's a petrol crisis, so you would have to wait 1 to 2 days to fill your car with gasoline, the price of which has gone up several times now since the occupation. And then if something were to happen to you, that you were caught up in fighting, for example, and were injured and had to go to a hospital, the hospitals don't have enough medication. Most of the equipment is outdated and broken down. Many of the doctors have left the country, and you're going into an environment where there's no heat, there's not enough medication. Some hospitals don't even have aspirin to give people for pain. The supply situation is so critical. The hospital administrators have admitted to me on the record that they have to reuse IV needles, risking infection, versus the people would just die if they didn't get the food that they need. So they have to reuse IV needles from patient to patient. So if you have to go to the hospital, it would be the situation. And then, once again, if you made it back home, of course, probably not finding any way to obtain a job or make money. And then to get home, and hopefully, if you're lucky again that night, your home would not be raided by soldiers and your family members, particularly young men, be detained by the forces for unknown reasons.
We are gearing up for the inaugural in the United States, and one of the big stories is just the amount of money being spent. There are $100,000 hotel rooms. You can go into great detail. People are renting hotels in Washington, D.C., where they're able to get a dress just like the one the Bush daughters are wearing, and they can, their bed will be coated with roses and a decoration of a W, and it just is very, very heavy coverage about the amount of money that will be spent on this carefully guarded inaugural. How are people that you talk to seeing this process in America? For one thing, do they even believe America's election was legit? Do they believe their upcoming election will be legit? What's the climate there?
Well, it's really just amazing, some of those things you just described. I hadn't heard all of that, and it's amazing, but I guess from what I've seen the Bush administration do already, I guess I can't say that it's surprising. But people hear regarding the Bush inauguration, it's really not even on the radar, since most people are so consumed with just the daily struggle to survive and not be killed in violence or by a car bomb or trying to find food or fuel for their car, for example. But regarding the election, Iraqis read very much, and they watch the news very much, and they're much more informed than probably the majority of people in the mainstream of America, and they're therefore more aware of the fact that it does not appear to have been a legitimate election in the U.S., and then that leads, of course, to the upcoming so-called election in Iraq, where most people already view it as illegitimate once again before it even occurs, because of the level of violence and because even people who do want to vote in so many places will not even be able to go to the polls because of the violence. And then we already have such huge percentages of the country who will just be outright boycotting the election simply because of the violence, and that they feel it would be better if it was delayed for, say, 6 months to try to sort out the situation to make it a bit more legitimate. Because the Association of Muslim Scholars' recent demand for the elections to be, that they would, in fact, participate in the elections if the U.S. would offer some sort of timetable for the withdrawal of their forces. And the U.S., why would they not do this if they're the ones talking about that this is a temporary situation, they will be withdrawing their forces? Colin Powell said this recently. Well, then why won't they simply meet these negotiations with the Muslim scholars? It's rather absurd. The doublespeak is everywhere, and it just, all of that adds up to further delegitimizing the upcoming election in Iraq. We still have to wait and see if it will even occur. Just to give you an idea of what it's going to be like having an election here if it does occur, the polling places have not been announced yet, because once they are announced, they will be bombed. Most of the candidates will not have their names on the list, because if they are announced, they will be assassinated. There will be no cell phone or satellite phone in Iraq for the day before, day of, day after the election. And it looks like now they're going to try to put a full curfew where no autos will be allowed to drive during those days either. So this is the democracy that the Bush administration has brought to Iraq.
How do people see the fact that so many voters, I think it's 1 million voters around the world outside of Iraq, may participate in this election?
Yes, I've heard that estimate to be between 1 and 4 million Iraqis living outside of the country, and that does not sit very well with Iraqis here, because much like the people now sitting in the seats of power in the interim government, like Ayed Alawi, who's been a three-decade exile from Iraq, studied abroad, speaks English as if it's his first language, and these are the people now in power there's very much resentment towards them because the feeling on the ground is that with Iraqis that I speak with is that these people, that they haven't lived in Iraq for decades, and now they're going to come back here and try to run our country. We're the ones that lived through the wars. We're the ones that lived through the dictatorship. We're the ones that lived through the sanctions. And now it's our turn to try to take control of our country. And instead, the feeling is that that control is being usurped by these so-called Iraqis in the interim government. And then, of course, allowing Iraqis outside of the country, many of whom have never even perhaps lived in Iraq but only have citizenship, being allowed to participate in this vote that will only indirectly affect them. You can imagine the level of frustration and resentment that so many Iraqis here feel about that.
Now, there were voices calling from within the interim government for a delay. President Ghazi Al-Yawar and the Iraq Interim Minister of Defense, Mazen Shalhan, they both called for a delay in the election. Are their voices simply being overshadowed?
Yes, that's exactly what's happening. The fact that even the interim government itself is not solid, it's not unified in how it thinks that what the best course will be for the election. We have people resigning every single day, people being assassinated every single day. It's really an utter disaster, and what you mentioned really highlights the fact of how chaotic the situation is here, not even just on the ground with all the violence, but even within the interim government, even within some of the same parties, there are some who are for the election, some who are against, some who think they should just be delayed. This just gives you an idea of how chaotic and how much of a mess this situation is.
I'll share with you, Dar Jamail, a statement by Tom McDonald. He's a partner in the Washington office of a law firm, Baker and Hostetler. He monitored elections in Zimbabwe and Cambodia. This diplomat, Tom McDonald, has said, quote, "Elections have been held amid violence in other countries, but never in such chaotic conditions as those in Iraq." Comment on what this diplomat is telling us.
Well, I would agree with him 100%. Again, just the idea of having elections in a situation like this is completely absurd. Baghdad is definitely the most dangerous capital city of any country on the planet right now. This occupation is brutal and violent and bloody and getting worse on a daily basis. The U.S. military really does not have control here, as evidenced by the fact they have to keep going and using warplanes, for example, dropping bombs in civilian areas on a daily basis, and they're going to try to have elections in this sort of environment. In fact, it's even more destabilized and chaotic, even during the initial invasion of Iraq.
You have come across quite a bit of very, very terrible information about the death and destruction to lives in Iraq. Let's talk a little bit about your recent investigations into the death and damage to Iraqis.
Well, just a couple of days ago, I went over to Yarmouk Hospital, which is one of the larger hospitals here in Baghdad, and I had a look at, they have three small morgues there in the hospital, and just to give one idea of the level of violence and bloodshed here and how much Iraqis are suffering, literally all three coolers were overfilled with bodies. In some instances, because of explosions, there were half bodies. There were body parts. There were still people being brought in from Fallujah who'd been laying in the open streets for now over 6 weeks, their bodies partially eaten by dogs because people weren't able to get them and collect them and identify them and bury them. We had bodies completely burned, unrecognizable. It was the most horrendous thing I've ever seen. It's literally a big cooler, and even though it's kept at below freezing temperatures, the stench was horrific because these bodies were already so old. They were brought there. They're being kept there. There's nowhere for them to go because they're waiting on family members to identify them, yet some of the family members may be killed themselves. This is the situation here. The level of violence is really beyond imagination. There are black banners, basically death announcements, hanging around Baghdad everywhere. Most of them just have the names of people dead, but some of them do have the cause of death. And inevitably, it's this person died by an explosion or this person died by gunfire. And they're everywhere around Baghdad. And I've been in and out of here reporting for 8 of the last 13 months, and I've never seen so many black banners around Baghdad, and it seems like there's more every day.
Talk a little bit about some of the shootings that occurred during house arrest processes. We saw a little bit of coverage of this, just as we saw coverage of Abu Ghraib, and it was very shocking to see a U.S. GI just shoot an Iraqi at point-blank range. There has not been comprehensive coverage, though, of the way that these house arrests have proceeded and of events at Abu Ghraib and other prisons in the wake of the revelations about torture and the fact that so many Iraqis arrested have been innocent.
Well, I interviewed a man actually in the Dora district of Baghdad just a few days ago, and he had been detained in August of 2003 and held for 8 months, if I remember correctly. It was either 8 or 9 months. And seven of that was in Abu Ghraib. And he said that even when he was taken to Abu Ghraib, that a female soldier came up and talked to all the new detainees and said, "We know that between 90 and 95% of you are innocent. We know that most of you that are here because someone gave us bad information or that you may have had troubles with someone and they wanted to just get revenge. We know that, but this is the situation and here you are." So even the military, even people within the military admit that these people, the vast majority of them, are innocent. One thing before I move on to the next topic about the torture is I want to be real clear on is that it is still ongoing. The fact that there was a huge scandal in the media, there has been trials now of soldiers, does not change anything in Abu Ghraib. There are still photographs being taken, video being taken, and people being released occasionally from Abu Ghraib, and they're all still reporting the exact same stories, the atrocious stories that we all heard back in April and May of 2004. And as far as the home raids and the heavy-handed tactics in Fallujah, it does appear that it was a sort of standard operating procedure that the military would go into homes, open the doors, and just shoot people, whether they were in bed, which I have photographic evidence of, or whether they were in their kitchens cooking or in the bathrooms. But people were literally just shot in these home raids. I also interviewed a cameraman for LBC, Lebanese Broadcasting Corporation, and he was in there and actually was in a home during the siege in November, and he said that he personally saw with his own eyes soldiers come into homes and shoot people simply because they could not speak English, that the soldiers would order people to move to another side of the room or to go outside of the house. People could not understand them, so they just stood there, and they would be shot because the soldiers believed that these people were deliberately disobeying them. So Fallujah is this ongoing situation where it's been one war crime after another by the U.S. military. There's also been countless reports of phosphorus weapons being used, a type of napalm, as well as chemical weapons.
Dara, we've heard, too, that there are various grisly solutions that could be used in Iraq, and we can only hope that those are not introduced. We're talking about the possibility of genocidal kinds of attacks against the people of Iraq. I'd like you to talk a little bit about what the fears are. Talk about the whole idea of collective punishment. You've written a lot about that. And
well, as far as potential genocidal and extremely heavy-handed tactics to be used to try to deal with the violence here, they've already been used. Fallujah was genocide. The entire city was bombed to the ground. It's like a modern-day Dresden, if you will. 75% of the city has literally been bombed to the ground. So many civilians there, thousands of civilians have been killed. They had nothing to do with fighting. They were just there in their homes. We have chemical and phosphorus weapons used there. We have to this day the military maintaining checkpoints requiring people to get retina scans and fingerprints and get ID cards just to try to get into their homes. This is the situation there. What's the difference between that and some of the tactics used by Germany, for example, in World War II? And as far as other heavy-handed tactics, we have patrols going through and using similar tactics in Ramadi and Samarra now. Samarra residents now are required to have identification cards just to get into their own city. We have constant detentions going of Iraqis, whether they're guilty or not, just bringing them in from their homes with no reason and just checking a name, for example. There really is no credibility left in the eyes of most Iraqis for the occupation forces in the country. If there was credibility left, for example, up to Abu Ghraib, it was gone at that point. That just underscored the fact to so many Iraqis who may have been on the fence regarding the occupation that these people did not come here for our best interest. They did not come here to liberate us, because if they did, how could they do this to anyone, especially when so many of the people that this happened to were completely innocent?
The American people, particularly U.S. veterans, are organizing and are starting to realize that they must find a way to bring U.S. troops home, and that's their message. So you're hearing that message from Iraqi Muslim scholars who are suggesting that if the United States wants their support for elections, they should present an exit strategy. You're hearing the same message in the U.S. from scholars and people interested in security issues, from also U.S. veterans and newly formed, newly strengthened veterans organizations and families of those who have died in Iraq. Talk a little about this swell of new energy for bringing the troops home and to expose what's going wrong with the U.S. occupation and war in Iraq.
Yes, this is a very hopeful phenomena that is occurring, and it does seem to be gaining much ground, particularly as of late, of more soldiers coming back and then refusing to be redeployed to Iraq, of families of fallen soldiers who are becoming extremely active in the peace movement and not only speaking out against the war, but trying to educate people away from joining the military because they think that they'll be put to some sort of good use, rather than the reality is they'll probably just be used as more cannon fodder. We have so many people now speaking out, both in Iraq as well as back home, and groups being formed, for example, Iraq Veterans Against the War, who are actually Iraq veterans from the current Iraq conflict who founded this group of people who are getting soldiers to join, some of whom are even joining anonymously, and they're in Iraq now, and it's a group that started just about 4 months ago with 9 soldiers, and now it's well over 60. And this is gaining momentum. We have soldiers and military members going to Canada. It's starting to look a bit more like Vietnam, with more and more people speaking out, more people refusing to be deployed, and in essence, this sort of public awareness back home and political action is really going to be the only thing that will turn the tide of opinion back in the U.S., which really is what is going to need to happen to bring an end to this situation, much like what occurred in Vietnam.
Dar Jamil, an independent reporter from Anchorage, Alaska, has been reporting for Free Speech Radio News. His recent articles have been published in the Sunday Herald, Interpress Service, the website of The Nation magazine, and alternet.org. You will find his regular updates at darjamailiraq.com, darjamailiraq.com. I'm Dory Smith for The Crisis Vote. For further information on this broadcast, write to me at theshockvote@yahoo.com. This program was produced in the studios of listener-supported WHUS Stores, Radio for the People. The views and opinions expressed on this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or the University of Connecticut.
I believe in simple things. I believe in the preciousness of all beings. I believe in tomorrow. Despite the troubles we face, we because I believe.